I want you to especially hear that last phrase that he said. A new type of way of loving and living. That's the message that comes through in this ancient city. And a buddy of mine who actually has been to Turkey, made that trip, visited that place, I called him this week and I said, so what stuck out to you? Like as you walked away from Ephesus, what was the most amazing thing? And he said, just the fact that it is huge. Like even from the pictures, you just can't fathom how big that stadium is, that theater where they could fit all of those people shouting at Paul because they're all riled up about this new message, this new way that he is bringing to town. And so it helps a little bit in my mind as we look at these things, as we dig through history to demystify the past a little bit. If you were here last week, you heard Chad talk about the Ark of the Covenant and how what's inside is not really ghouls and ghosts that melt your face, right? Because a lot of times, those things that are like lost to history, we don't totally know what to make of it. And the same thing can often happen with ancient cities. You know, we think about people in the Greco-Roman Empire that have a culture somewhat similar to ours, and yet, did they really think Zeus was real? Did they really worship Diana? Did they really buy that many little silver statues that it was propping up the entire economy of an ancient city? And so we can think that they're different than us, that they're strange, that they're probably not as smart as we are. We live in 2025, like we know what's really going on. And yet they are very much like us. That what was important in Ephesus was business, success, family, entertainment, comforts and pleasures, all the good things of life were happening in Ephesus. And Ephesus sat kind of right in the middle of the Roman Empire, where it would transition from Europe and the West to Asia and the East. And so for that reason, Diana, the goddess that they had in Ephesus, Diana was the goddess of the crossroads. It was a crossroads for commerce. It was a crossroads for religion. You have people coming from every corner of the earth through Ephesus, bringing new ideas about how to do this, new ideas about how to lead your family, new ideas about how to do business, new ideas about religion. That's part of why when you look at ancient Roman and Greek gods, they're the god of like 50 different things, because every time a new god comes into town, they just kind of wrap it into the one they already have. That's why she gets called Artemis or Diana. She's the goddess of the crossroads. She's the goddess of the hunt. She's the goddess of the moon. She's the goddess of the underworld. She's the goddess of, like, you name it, you roll it into town, and we just throw it on the pile and keep buying our little silver statues and keep going over to our temple. So Ephesus was the place you came to figure out the way to go. This is the crossroads. And when you hit a crossroads, how do you make those decisions? How do you decide what should be most important for your life? What you should do next with your company, with your career, with your family? So they're already used to asking those kinds of questions when Paul shows up. And he says, instead of thinking about all the different ways you could go, let me tell you about the way. In fact, I think it's interesting when you look at the historical record of the book of Acts, where this event is captured. Notice in that first sentence, about that time there arose a great commotion about the way. That phrase is being used to describe Christianity and the message of Jesus. And so instead of saying a great commotion about Jesus or a great commotion about Christianity, it says there was a great commotion about the way. I think that's so fitting in a city like Ephesus, where they were always looking for what's the right way, that this isn't called a new way, it's called the way. So this historical record, the book of Acts, if you didn't know, we often talk about the four biographies of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Acts is basically the sequel to those biographies. It picks up immediately after Jesus' death and resurrection, as the Bible records it, and now it's that first generation of people, the first men and women who saw that happen, who believed that was real, who wanted to follow Jesus, trying to live it out, trying to share that message. Paul is one of those guys who brings it to Ephesus, and it causes a great commotion. And so here's why. It says, a certain man named Demetrius. There we go. A certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Diana, brought no small profit to the craftsmen. He called them together with the workers of similar occupation and said, "Not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana." So you see the conflict of ideas that is happening here in the middle of the city. But you also see two major historical claims happening here. One is that in Ephesus, there is a temple to the goddess Diana. The second is that the message of Christianity was changing Ephesus overnight. When you read that entire chapter of this historical book, it describes how people were throwing away their idols, getting rid of all of their like Diana t-shirts that, you know, that they bought at the gift store. Like, they're unloading all of their Diana stuff, which has been there for centuries, virtually overnight, because of this message about Jesus. The reason it causes such commotion is because it's not just saying, here's one more way to throw on the pile. Here's another little thing you can add into Diana. Oh, sure, Diana can also be the Diana of the cross or the Diana of the forgiveness. Instead, Paul is picking up on Jesus' own words. In fact, in the biography about Jesus called John, this is how he puts it: I am the way. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father, Jesus says, except through me. So in a culture where they had a different God for every city and sometimes multiples and sometimes a little shrine in their own home for the goddess of their own home, he's saying, none of those work. We don't all find our own way. There's only one way, and Jesus says, it's me. So what convinced Ephesus that that was true? What evidence were they seeing that made them change overnight? Well, I think that's the same thing that we want to ask. When we look at these kinds of things, we want to dig for evidence that points the way. Because if you're like me, I'm just skeptical enough that even if that sounds amazing, I'm not just going to buy that. Right? If you imagine, like, whatever your Ephesus version of your life is, you know, what do you do every day? What's part of your normal rhythm? And would you change that at the drop of a hat just because a nice man from some other city came into town and said, did you know there's actually only one God and I know him and I'll tell you? Maybe it's logical, but I'd like a little proof. So what was convincing them? What were they digging into that they saw? And can we dig into the same thing? Because maybe Demetrius was right. Maybe this Jesus stuff is a problem. Maybe Paul was right, and Jesus really is the only thing out there. Well, that was the same kind of questions that a man named J.T. Wood was asking. J.T. Wood ends up becoming famous for discovering Ephesus, which is kind of interesting because we know it's in Turkey. I already told you I had a friend of mine that went and visited there. Chad, I think, has been there as well. Like, you can go see it today. It's one of the most popular tourist places in Turkey. But for centuries, they didn't know where it was. So they were pretty sure Ephesus existed, but for centuries, they didn't know where the Temple of Diana was. And there were actually many scholars who believed that maybe the temple never existed, despite the historical record written about it. So J.T. Wood, he's actually British, but he comes to Turkey, and his job there was to build a railroad, to dig for a railroad, to lay the track. When he gets there, he finds out that people have been digging for Ephesus and can't find it. He gets so intrigued by this, he gives up on digging the railroad, didn't even finish the job, and he starts digging for Ephesus. He thinks he can find it because he's read in the Bible that there's supposed to be a temple of Diana. If we find the temple, we'll find Ephesus. And so essentially what happens is it's kind of like in the first Indiana Jones movie, there's that scene where Indy is talking to his friend Sala. So like if Chad is Indiana Jones, I'm Sala. I'm the friend with the beard. Okay, so I grew this for this week so I could be John Rhys Davies in Indiana Jones. Not wearing the fez because it would mess up my hair. But in that scene, if you remember this, like that Nazi in the first movie burned that thing into his hand, but because of that, they only got like one side of it. So there's a scene where they realize the Nazis don't have all the information. They're digging in the wrong place. And then they go and find what they're looking for. Same thing happened here. When he starts digging, he realizes everyone's been digging for a harbor town. They're digging too close to the water. All of that stuff had been filled in. It's now like a 20-minute drive from Ephesus to the harbor because so much of it has been filled in with land. So he starts digging inland, and here's what he finds that breaks the whole thing wide open. They dug up an inscription that described how little silver statues of Diana would be carried from the temple to the theater. As soon as he found that, he knew we found Ephesus. Because in Acts 19, it perfectly describes that exact scene. Little silver shrines in the temple of the goddess Diana, right in the same town where Paul is dragged to this massive theater. So when he finds that little inscription, he says, this matches everything that the Bible said would be true about Ephesus. I think we found it. They start digging. They find the temple. They find the school. They find the theater. They uncover the entire city of Ephesus. And it perfectly matches the Bible's record. Now, here's why I think that's important. Because there are a lot of religious books in the world that just claim to be rules about how to live or just books of religion. But the Bible claims to be history, and it gives incredible amounts of detail. I mean, think about the fact that we're reading a record from 2,000 years ago, but it's got this guy by name, Demetrius, who starts the riot, specifically describes the silver shrines that they would make, specifically describes the temple. There are so many facts that you can check up on here that if it were me, if I look at that and it says, actually, there was no such thing as Ephesus, and there were no silver shrines, and there really was no temple of Diana. But I'm sure everything else the Bible is saying is true. I don't know. Would you believe that? But part of why that level of detail is in here is so that we can verify it. So that when I read this, when J.T. Wood digs like this, if he says, that's got to be there, right? If you can take the Bible as accurate history, then what archaeologists will tell you, even ones who don't follow Jesus, they would tell you they read the Bible so that they know where to dig. Now that's incredible to me, because even archaeology is a relatively young discipline. We've really only been digging for the last 150 years or so. Because for most of history, you build a city, we conquer your city, we build on top of your city. We reuse all of your stuff, we build our own city. Then someone conquers our city, they build on top of our city. Like, that's most of human history. Nobody was preserving things, nobody was building museums, until just a little over 100 years ago where people started digging for stuff. And so it's kind of incredible to think that you can have centuries of manuscript evidence recording this history, but really, in the last 100 years, and like every day right now, they're just finding more and more and more archaeological evidence that supports the Bible. Now, when I find that, when I say, if this book was right about those details, I wonder what else it's right about. If it was right about Demetrius, if it was right about Diana, I wonder if it's right about Jesus. So what else is in this book? Let's go back to Ohio Hovind to find out.
Now here's where this incredible Greek-Roman city, 250,000 people, comes face to face with the Bible. Ancient scrolls and letters like you see around us were written to this part of the country. We have found two ancient documents. One is the letter to the Ephesians, and it records this transformative message about love and sacrifice and care for the people around you. Separately, we found another document. This one written by an ancient historian named Luke, recording the history of the early church, which records Paul's encounters here in this city. What does he come to say? He comes to say to the Greeks and Romans, you guys have followed gods like Zeus, gods who are domineering and are angry, and the way they parent and the way they treat other people is very self-centered. But what Paul says is the God of the Hebrew Scriptures came to earth in the form of Jesus, and he came to be a different kind of dad, one who sacrifices for others, loves others, puts the needs of other people ahead of his own. What if we loved in marriage like that? What if we loved at work like that? What if we treated our kids and our parents like that?
So that first manuscript piece that it showed, what he called the letter to the Ephesians. So that was something that Paul wrote after visiting Ephesus on this trip, going through this riot, seeing all these people turn their lives over, like completely change, start following Jesus. He writes a letter back to them, encouraging them how to keep living in that Jesus way. And the first manuscript you saw in that video is actually from the fifth section of that letter. And I want to show you a piece of that right now, because this is one of the things that is incredible about the Bible, right? We're living in 2025 AD. He visited back in 52 AD, and within 10 years, the book of Acts, the historical record we've been looking at, happened, and this letter that he writes to his friends back in Ephesus who are now following Jesus. So even though they don't dig anything up until 1869, we've never actually lost this record of the Temple of Diana, of the city of Ephesus, or of the message that the Bible was bringing. And so as Paul writes this letter, look at what he says in the fifth section of Ephesians, and it's the first sentence in that section. Therefore, be imitators of God as dear children, and walk in love as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us. So that message is all throughout the Bible, and it becomes very familiar. But now think of that with the ears of an Ephesian citizen. Be imitators of God. Friends, you would never say that about Zeus. Zeus cheats on his wife about 3 times a week. He is always angry. If you ask them in their own time, why do you love Zeus? They would say, we don't love Zeus. Zeus is scary. Right? Well, why do you love Apollos? Well, we don't love him either. He's scary. But here's the thing about Poseidon. He's scary. And so if I am getting in a boat and I've never seen him and I've never seen his sea monsters, but just in case they are real, I better make a sacrifice because I don't want the boat to go down. And you would never tell them, imitate the gods. The gods, honestly, are like made in human image. They are like all the worst parts of us hopped up on superpowers. It's betrayal, it is sexual immorality, it is just rage all the time, constant wars, and then they just throw all the humans into it and say, go fight for us. You would never tell them to imitate the gods. So notice how different this line is. First that he says, act like God does. I'm sorry, tell me more about your God before I agree to that. But notice, he doesn't say, be imitators of the gods, or a God, or my God. He says, be imitators of God. That there's only one. Well, who is he? Well, look at the very next phrase. I mean, there's just so much packed in here. Be imitators of God as dear children. Children of God? This is a completely different image from the way that we often think about it. All right, so maybe you're not worried about Zeus and Apollos, and I bet nobody came in here this morning really trying to decide between Jesus and Poseidon. But how do you think about God? When you imagine God, do you imagine him looking at you as a dear child? That he would love a hug from you? My nephews are visiting me this weekend, and one of them is about 3 years old. He's got like perfect language for a 3-year-old. And it's just so cute. You know, they're tiny little voices and they come up and they play with you and they give you a hug. And when they warm up to you and they give you that big smile, the way you look at that child, do you believe that that's how God looks at you? Whether you think about Zeus or Poseidon or anything else, if you imagine God, does he look at you as dear children? Because then he's telling them, walk in love as Christ also has loved us. Is he saying Christ is God? That Jesus is the God who loves you. That's why he gave himself up for us. That the main message of the Bible, that all of us fall short of God's perfect standard, that we need someone to rescue us, to forgive us, to make us right in that relationship again. That's what Jesus did when he died on the cross. That's what Jesus did when he rose from the grave. The message here is, Forget all the other things you've committed your life to. Here's a God who loves you and sees you as his child and gave himself up for you. You see, what they were doing at the Temple of Diana was different. This is a modern representation of what they think the temple probably looked like based on the pieces that they've found. What was once described as the greatest of all of the seven wonders of the ancient world was a place where they worshiped pleasure, success, comfort, control, entertainment. And that's where you realize that, like, they built little statues for it and they put up temples for it, but that actually sounds a lot like us. What if there was a different way, because there's a God who sees you as a child, who loves you like a child, who gave himself up for you? See, the way of Jesus is the way of love. That we walk in love because you are loved. Instead of you better be nice because the gods are mean, what if it was we get to love others the way he's loved us? Think about how that would change your relationships. For example, in the city of Ephesus, marriage was kind of a tricky thing. So that's probably true anywhere. But in Ephesus, because Diana was the goddess of the hunt, that meant that Diana was wild. And so they perceived all women, like their goddess, as wild. The men were the civilized ones. Right. So here's what they were telling men. Men, you need to tame your woman. And here's what they were telling women. Women, never be tamed. Like, to the point of, don't even get married. Diana wouldn't get married, and neither should you. So imagine now in a marriage, the man thinking his primary job is to tame you, and the woman feeling like she probably failed by letting him marry her in the first place. How do you think that goes for the next 50 years of holy matrimony? Right? Disastrous. And again, we think, boy, Ephesus had problems. But I can just tell you, from friends, from pastoral conversations, Google it. How many of our problems in relationships start because I'm actually only thinking about what I want and I'm trying to keep control, and they're actually only thinking about what they want and they're trying to keep control? Because isn't the most important thing that I feel happy? What if that looked different? I was having breakfast with a buddy of mine a few months ago, and he was a young married guy, young kids, career's taken off, so doing lots of travel. And as we sat down and we were just talking about life, he's like, man, here's what's kind of been hard lately. You know, I go out on this business trip, I'm gone for 4 days, and then when I get home, so I don't know if you've ever been on trips like that, but I know when I get home, for some reason, I always think there's going to be a parade for me. I'm going to open the front door, and this would be like balloons and streamers. Dad, you know, he's like, yeah, that's it. I was like, but instead, I open the door, and like, the house is a mess, and my wife's a mess, the kids are a mess, everything's a mess. And the first thing I hear is, oh, good, can you please help me? Like, help you what? You didn't even clean the house. And then they got in this big fight. Because both people are thinking, you have no idea how hard I've been working and you don't realize how much I do. And well, I'm doing this for the family. I'm trying to provide for us. And right, we've probably, if you're married, we've all been there. But as he was talking to me, he said as he's been kind of exploring this Jesus stuff, he keeps hearing things like, you know, I should forgive others because Jesus forgave me. And I can love others because he loved me. And I can serve others because he served me. So I'm trying it. So we talked about what it looked like to walk into the home if I really mean that I'm here to try to serve even if nobody serves me. And he said at first it was frustrating, but after a little while, it was like his wife kind of started to notice. A little while longer, and she kind of started to say thank you here and there. A little while longer, and she started doing it too. And now they're able to just talk to each other about how instead of constantly battling to try to make it 50-50, I'll do my 50, but you got to do your 50. Now they both try to go into it saying, hey, I'm just going to give 100%. I'm just going to do my part. Trying to follow that Jesus way. In fact, in this letter to the Ephesians, Paul uses this word as he describes how our relationships could look different. And the word he uses is submit. That's like a dirty word, isn't it? Nobody wants to submit. But he actually says, submit to one another. Wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, sacrifice yourself for your wives. And essentially what he's saying is, be humble enough to voluntarily give up my needs, my wants, for someone else's. Walking in that way of love. And watch how that transforms your family. The second thing he really tells them in this fifth section is, he says, you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. So walk as children of light. Now again, this kind of language is all over the Bible, that God is moving us from darkness to light. He's not just taking good people and helping them be a little bit better. He's not just giving us good advice. It's like we were lost in the dark, and he wants to show us the way. And this makes a lot of sense, again, in Ephesus, because Diana, part of her thing was goddess of the moon and goddess of the underworld. So what's kind of crazy about this is not me picking on Diana. This is, you look up the ancient research. If you feel like you're lost in the dark and you come to a crossroads and you don't know which way to go and you ask Diana, she will tell you the way to go, and it usually leads to the underworld. Why is anybody following Diana? You compare that to the message that they hear about Jesus and that we're hearing right now. Jesus says, I want to shine light into the darkness. To the dark parts of my heart, where I hold unforgiveness, where I've been hurt, where I know I've made mistakes and I carry regrets. To take that darkness and bring light and bring forgiveness. Friends, that's what I love about being able to read the same thing that they read back then, thousands of years ago, as they were reading this letter. Because I know sometimes the Bible gets a bad rap, like somebody wrote the Bible, and then the next generation didn't like it that much, and they tweaked it a little bit, and they pulled this part, and they added that thing, and then the next generation didn't like that much, and so they pulled this part and tweaked that thing. That's actually not how it works. So the New King James Version that we use here, Horizon, what you're seeing on the screen, what I'm holding in my hand, is directly translated from copies of the original Greek. So that I'm literally reading an English translation of the same letter that they received in Ephesus almost 2,000 years ago. Because you see, what they're being told is what we're being told. It's not just the way of love, it's the way of light. That we can walk in light and as light. That once you see the light, now you're able to show the way for others. I saw just an awesome example of this. I was talking to my friend Bill. I remembered he'd shared this story with me, but I'd forgotten some of the details. Because a number of years ago, the company that Bill was working for, he had a day where he went into work, and it's like, you know, there are just those days where life changes all at once. He went into work, doing his job, gets called in to the boss, finds out he's fired. Fired? Like, what happened? So he discovered later that somebody else in the company had lied about him. Like, literally just angry at Bill, jealous at Bill, whatever, lied about him, and it cost Bill his job. So he goes back into the boss's office. He decides, I'm not going to retaliate. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to get angry. But I do want to talk to him and try to set the record straight. And by the end of that meeting, he'd actually been promoted to the boss's level. So a little bit later, he told me he was standing on the 68th floor of the Empire State Building, and another guy that he works with came to him who'd kind of seen this whole thing happening, kind of knew what happened and heard how it came out, and just was stunned by how different Bill acted compared to everybody else. Like, how would you act if you knew somebody lied about you and it cost your job? What kind of tear would you go on through the office? And Bill didn't go on that tear. So standing on the 68th floor, this guy simply asked Bill, why are you the way you are? And in that moment, Bill decided, I think I just got to tell him the truth. And he answered him, I'm trying to be like Jesus. And he shared with that guy who Jesus is, what it means that Jesus was here to love us, to die for us, to forgive us, to show us what it's like to serve others, to be truthful, but to be gentle and kind, and that he was trying to live his life the way that Jesus lived his life. I knew that part of the story. And when I asked Bill about it this week, make sure I had permission, make sure I had my details right, what I did not know, the guy standing on the 68th floor with him, asking him that question, was the guy who lied about him. Bill didn't even know that at the time. But it completely changed the way that guy thought about who Jesus is. So, if Bill were up here with me, he would tell you he's not a perfect person either. Only Jesus is, right? But what a cool example that when God brings light into my life, now I begin to show that love and that light to other people. Friends, that's why Ephesus changed overnight. That is what is so compelling about Scripture, because I want you to see now what the temple of Artemis looks like today. That's it. That's all that's left. And even this, they didn't find that column. They found random pieces scattered across the whole area, and that was all they could pull together to try to put one column back together of what was once one of the greatest wonders of the ancient world. Here's my point. Nobody follows Diana in 2025. Nobody cares about Artemis anymore. There are billions of followers of Jesus all over the world right now. Because the manuscript evidence is convincing, an unbroken record for 2,000 years. The archaeological evidence is amazing. They're literally reading the Bible to know where to dig and finding more stuff like every day. It's incredible. But perhaps the most compelling evidence is the evidence of lives that are changed. Not just by taking Jesus' advice and trying to be more like him, but by believing that he really does love you. That he gave himself up so we could be forgiven. That he's willing to be your forgiver and your leader in your life. You can ask my wife the difference between me when I'm listening to Jesus and me when I'm not. And she would tell you, that's the best evidence that Jesus is real. Like Drew 10 years ago versus Drew today. And I would tell you too, he's the difference. I've had plenty of times in my life where I try to get better at this and I try to do better at that and I try this over here. But when I relax, trust Jesus and ask him, would you help me be more like you? That's when things start to change. So here's my encouragement for us this morning. It's for me. I hope maybe it's for you too. Dig into one way this week. Dig into one way to walk in the way. You know, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So maybe that one way is for the first time saying, Jesus, I want to trust you for my forgiveness. I want to trust you as my leader. Show me your way. But maybe like the friend I was having breakfast with, you're like, I don't know, I still have questions. I still have things I'm wrestling with. Well, maybe just try it. Maybe this week, try one way with your spouse to give yourself up, to willingly submit to their needs instead of your own. One way with your teenager to show them that you love them more than you love yourself. One way at work, where like Bill's story, you might be different in a situation where everyone thinks they know what to expect, but you act like Jesus instead. Because friends, this is your life. This is my life. And like in Ephesus, they were asking themselves, am I really who I want to be? Is this really the way I want to go? Or am I willing to try the way of Jesus? Can we just take a minute? I'd love to just pray for you. Just talk to God for a minute about what we've heard. God, there are definitely things in my life that I regret. I know that is true for all of us. Things where we would look back at our lives and say, I'm not who I want to be. And so in this moment, Lord, we would just ask for your forgiveness. Remembering what we've heard this morning, that you lived and loved and gave yourself up for us, Jesus, so that we could be forgiven. And I don't know what every person here is thinking this morning, Lord, what questions we might have, but I would just ask that if we walk out of this place this week, thinking about how you're the way, thinking about how you might live, thinking about how you might treat the people around us, and that we try your way, would you just help us to see the joy of it, to see that change, that you would show up in those moments with us and give us the strength to actually do it. And we'll just ask you for that by your grace and by the name of Jesus. Amen.